And welcome to week three of the series Leader in You. Before we start today, I want to just dedicate today's shiur, because of the intelligence that I have. Today is Judy Lindsay's birthday. Sunday's her Hebrew birthday. So I wish her a year of success and only blessing and good things. So just to, first of all, do a bit of review, just summarize what we've covered so far. Also, welcome back to Mandy. She's been on a trip for a long time. A raffle winner for this year. So far, we've just established a few different ideas. Number one, we've talked about... We've talked about leadership being an attitude rather and a mindset, not a position of authority. We've talked about the idea that we all have a circle of influence, and we can and we should take those people under our circle of influence and lead them, meaning leading not in the sense of authority necessarily, but concept of guiding, inspiring, lifting, and so on. But it does require taking responsibility, not remaining silent, as we talked about last week and the week before. And also requires a certain amount of strength, the concept of having confidence, and to stand up and even say things and do things something sometimes that are not popular, which ties into the concept we spoke about last week of Avraham Avinu going against the current, which is why we are called Ivri. Avraham Ivri, the Hebrew, and Hebrew comes from the word Ivri, to be on the other side, not necessarily to be with everyone else, but even to do things sometimes that are unpopular in the context of inspiring others and leading others. So far we've developed this as a concept of a mindset and an attitude, but what we need to look at is how does this play out? What does this look like? In terms of strategy, what does it actually mean? How do we develop all of this? So I want to begin today with a thought that will be the foundation of today's discussion. And the idea is as follows: to understand that when we talk about leadership, and leadership in the context of our discussion, leadership in the sense of inspiring others, leadership by influence rather than by power, as we talked about last week, leadership by inspiration and so on. But to have effective leadership on anyone, even if it's a few people that are close to us, leadership actually requires a range of opposites. Okay? A range of opposite character traits. Now, the truth is that it's not unique to leadership. The truth is, as we've spoken about many, many times, just to summarize, this is not a new idea. The truth is that any human experience to be effective, any relationship to be effective, requires opposites, which is the difficulty and the challenge always, because the opposites that we normally talk about is the combination of chesed and gvura. We've talked about this many, many times. Requires giving, loving, tolerance, accepting, but also requires discipline, control, sometimes strength, harshness, even sometimes firmness, and so on and so forth. And that's necessary in everything. We've talked about this many, many times, how every relationship needs love and respect. Love and respect comes from chesed and gvura. It's giving, being close, but also respecting space. Parenting requires a relationship of love, but it requires firmness. And that's all relationships. In fact, most human experiences and the way we go through life in a meaningful and purposeful way always requires two opposites. And that's always the challenge, because most people are born with a particular disposition. Most people are born with a particular personality, which makes it sometimes hard to live a life with opposite character traits, which is the challenge of the human being and our unique opportunity. That's how we grow, that's how we work. We've talked about this many times, that growth requires engaging and entertaining certain mindsets or personalities that might not be our natural default disposition, right? So that's true always, but with leadership we find this even more pronounced. That leadership requires real opposite personalities. And we need the combination, the merging of different mindsets and different character traits. So let's go through a couple of examples. Let's just test this a little bit, how it plays out. So when we have a circle of influence, right? So everyone has a different circle of influence. It could be children, it could be friends, students, or wider community, whatever the case is. Every person is in a different position of leadership, but yet everyone has an opportunity for leadership, as we've talked about last 2 weeks. So the first ingredient to effective leadership, to lift and inspire and influence others, is that those who we lead on any level, we have to have a very, very strong relationship with that person or with those people, right? There has to be a love of that person. To lead them effectively, there has to be a love of them and an acceptance of them. In other words, we cannot inspire or influence other people unless we have a relationship with them. No one effectively inspires or influences or lifts top down with no effective relationship. It doesn't work, right? You know, the Talmud tells a story, I think we might have mentioned the story in the past, that there was a great sage called Rabba who used to lecture his students. Now, when we talk about Rabba, this great sage, lecturing his students, it wasn't just sharing some thoughts. Lecturing the students in a Talmudic context meant someone as great and with deep, deep insight as he had, coming to share new insights and new thoughts and life-changing messages sometimes to a group of his students, correct? So therefore, we are taught that the lecture itself would be a solemn experience. In other words, it was intense. The focus and the respect that the students needed to have would be quite serious, quite intense, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to receive what he was teaching. In other words, they needed to really focus. They needed to really defer to his wisdom. They needed to be in a mindset where they respected his greater level of intelligence or insight and so on and so forth. And therefore, the lecture itself would be quite an intense experience. Yet, we are taught that when he would begin his lecture, this great sage, the Talmud says, he'd always like tell a joke first. He would like say something light in order to get everyone laughing. And then he would launch into his lecture, which would be much more intense and serious. Now, the commentaries explain that this wasn't just a public speaking tactic. It was a thought-out strategy. Because he wanted to have the student-teacher relationship with them, and it wasn't just sharing knowledge, but it was teaching them in the sense of changing them, influencing them, bringing them along with his journey, and that experience would have been quite a focused and intense experience, he first needed to develop a relationship with them. The first needed to be that closeness, that lightness and that closeness. And therefore, he would start with a sort of a light comment, have them laugh, he'd laugh with them, there'd be that sort of atmosphere of closeness and bonding, and only then he could start his actual lecture. And that's just a concept that in order to relate to someone, in order to lead someone on any level, one has to have a relationship with that person. Now, part of that relationship, in terms of leadership, means unconditional acceptance. If you're leading someone effectively, the person will never receive from you or never be guided or inspired by you unless the person feels accepted. And feels accepted means to accept another human being without judgment, not to judge another person. People who feel judged don't normally take any guidance or inspiration from the people that they perceive to be judging them, right? So therefore, a real relationship means to have a relationship with someone means to have a connection with them, to have a bond with them, to relate to them, and to accept them without judgment. However, and this is the opposite that we want to explore today a little bit. However, at the same time, when you accept someone and you relate to someone and you accept someone without judgment, it doesn't mean agreeing with that person. And what it does mean in terms of leadership, it does mean having the ability to challenge the person. Now, we need to develop this, how that works, because what does that mean to accept someone unconditionally and yet to challenge them? Right. Because leadership, equally important to leadership, is the concept of challenging the status quo, challenging what is. Because if you think about leadership, leadership means to influence people. Leadership means to take people along on a ride, on a journey, to lift people, to enable people to grow. And therefore, there really cannot be effective leadership without challenging. So I just wanted to sort of plant this as the beginning, that we see already we see two opposite things. On the one hand, we're talking about the closeness and real acceptance of another person, and yet the ability to strongly challenge that person so that they can go out of themselves, they can go beyond their status quo, beyond their comfort zone, and challenge them to grow, and challenge them to change, challenge them to come along to a different space. Right? And I'll share with you a nice insight from Rabbi Sachs's book on this. He talks about what he perceives as the first real leader, Abraham, as we talked about last week. And the reason he sees him as the first leader is because we said last week, Abraham was not a leader of a community. He didn't have a community. Yet he was probably one of the greatest leaders because he inspired millions of people. To us as Jews, he's considered the first Jew. Other religions consider him the father of their religion and so on and so forth. So he was a great leader in that sense. Now, there's an interesting story with Abraham. And this took place in a time where God was going to destroy the city of Sodom, right? Sodom and Gomorrah, an evil society. God had decided to destroy them. This happened just after the story of the three angels that came to Abraham. And then we find a verse that says like this, that God says to himself, he says, "Hamechase ani me'Avraham, should I conceal from Abraham what I'm about to do?" Now, it wasn't really Abraham's problem. Abraham wasn't the father of the people in Sodom and Gomorrah. But nevertheless, Abraham was considered beloved to God. He's such a great person. He's going to be the father of a great nation. "It's only right," says God, "that I share with him what I'm about to do." So he comes to Abraham and he shares with him his plan that he's about to destroy the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. What does Abraham do? He gives God a really hard time. In the human sense, we'd say that he would have regretted telling him this, right? Like, if I knew such tzaras, I would never have told him, right? And Abraham starts with God, and he has a whole conversation which the Torah records. A real back-and-forth conversation. Abraham says to God, "You can't do this. How can you destroy a place? Maybe there's some righteous people there. Maybe, it's a big community. Maybe there's 50 righteous people there. And if there's 50 righteous people there, what are you going to... Is it right? Is it just to go and just... to use modern language, carpet bomb the whole place, and you're going to kill the righteous with the evil?" God says, "Don't worry, I understand. There's no 50 righteous people there. I've checked it. No, nowhere close." So Abraham doesn't give up, and he says, "Sorry for being chutzpahdik, but maybe there's 40 people, maybe 30 people, 20 people, 25 people, 10 people. Anyway, it doesn't help, and at the end, there's no good people there, except for Lot, of course, Abraham's nephew, which was saved from Sodom, and God had already sent him out. But other than that, they were all evil enough to deserve God's punishment, and God destroys Sodom." So we have to understand actually what actually happened here. Why did actually God share that with him, and what was the purpose of it, right? So Rabbi Sachs says, and this is an interesting insight, it's an interesting angle on the thing. He says that God knew what he was going to do, right? And he knew the statistics, and it was a logical argument that Abraham came, but obviously God had already thought that through, one would imagine. But God shares this with Abraham, he says, to give Abraham the opportunity to challenge him. Why? Why was it necessary for Abraham to challenge him? Surely God knew the answer to the challenge. Surely God had worked out already that there's no one just and righteous there, and therefore God was anyways going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Why was it necessary for Abraham to know this information and to be given the opportunity to challenge? Because God knew, he says, that Abraham was going to become a great leader. He was going to be the father of a nation or many nations. And a leader has to know how to challenge. In this case, it was God. But a leader has to know how to challenge. So God wanted to give Abraham the opportunity to challenge. Now the truth is, it wasn't the first time God had done this. God had given Noah the opportunity to challenge, and Noah didn't take it. And as we know, as we said I think 2 weeks ago, the fundamental difference between Noah and Abraham is that Noah wasn't a leader. He was a righteous man, but not a leader. He was a tzaddik in the fur coat. Remember the analogy we gave a couple of weeks ago? He didn't challenge God. God came to Noah and says, "Listen, I'm going to save you, but I'm about to destroy the entire world. I'm going to bring a flood. Build a teva, build a box, and protect yourself." And Noah says, "Okay, no problem." Why doesn't he turn around and challenge God? Why doesn't he say, "Well, maybe it's not such a good idea. Maybe the people will be able to return. Maybe they're able to repair themselves. Maybe they can improve," and so on and so forth. He just accepts it. He doesn't challenge. But Noah really wasn't a leader. As Rabbi Sacks points out, that's why he calls Abraham the first leader, because Adam was a great person, but he didn't take responsibility, right? The first ingredient to leadership is responsibility. Cain and Abel didn't take responsibility. He wouldn't take responsibility for murdering his brother. Noach didn't even take collective responsibility. The first one who stood up, who was an Ivri, who was prepared to fight the current, who was prepared to be strong, was Abraham. Abraham challenged God. But he challenged God, and therefore God knew, this is a leader. A person who is able to challenge. Sorry, can I ask someone just to press the heat? It's very hot in here. Mm-hmm. Just that green button, just to press it. Thanks. Now, what's interesting is going back to the thought we said before, that who was Abraham that he had this ability to challenge? To challenge takes a tremendous strength. And we know, what we know of Abraham, we know of Abraham, is he was a person of love. In fact, Kabbalistically, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov refer to the first three of the emotions, Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferet, right? He was a person of Chesed. Kabbalistically, there's a Kabbalistic idea that it says that the supernal attribute of Chesed, whatever that means, came before God and said, as long as Abraham is alive, I'm out of business. Because Abraham was a man of Chesed, he was a man of love, a man of complete and absolute tolerance. Accepted everyone, everything. He loved to be hospitable. He was. You can't get more love and acceptance than Abraham. And yet he had the strength to challenge, because that's a leader. A leader is someone who can have both. We'll see how it plays out in his life, but he can have love, and he needs to have love, and he needs to have acceptance, and yet he's able to challenge. So how does that all come together? How does that work? So let's understand. Let's just work through a little bit of here. What does it mean to be non-judgmental? Right? It's hard not to be judgmental, but what does it actually mean? We talk about not being judgmental. What does that mean? What does it mean to accept another person unconditionally? Does it mean to look at the person without any flaws? Does it mean that to just think that whatever the person does is fantastic? No. I think the first ingredient about being non-judgmental is that it comes together with the concept of humility. The first ingredient to not judging another person means to never ever have the sense that I am superior to another person. Which means even if I think that there are areas that person can improve on, maybe I think that person has areas that I see that I can help them improve, which means they have deficiencies, they have weaknesses, and maybe it's part of my responsibility because they're in my circle of influence. But it doesn't mean that I define them by those weaknesses in any way, and it doesn't mean that I am superior to that person. I might not have that weaknesses, but I have other weaknesses. And even if I don't have those weaknesses, it doesn't make a difference. Weaknesses don't define a person, and therefore when I look at someone else, maybe I don't agree with every part of that person, and not only I don't agree, but I'm so passionate about the values which I see lacking in the other person that I'm prepared to inspire the other person because they do come under my circle of influence, and leadership is about taking responsibility and not being silent and not just letting it go and not being passive. But the starting point is that I don't feel superior to that person, and the person doesn't feel that they're being looked on by someone who feels themselves to be superior. That's what acceptance means, right? Because they might have something lacking that I don't have, it doesn't make me a better person. That's not what defines a good and better person. And being non-judgmental, which means even if the other person has clearly made a mistake, let's say, number one, the leader doesn't define the person by their mistake, number one. And number two, this is an important part and a difficult thing to have. There's a saying that the rabbis tell us in the Gemara that a person have a shval ruach bifnei kol adam. That a person should feel themselves low and humble before every human being. Now, it's one thing to feel humble before some human beings. But how do you feel humble before every human being? I mean, you know, we all know a lot of people that are really not good people, let's say, right? So I'm supposed to feel humble before them? You know, feel humble in front of good people, that's one thing, but okay, you know, I don't feel superior, maybe. Okay, you can feel humble. But feel humble, bifnei kol adam, that's the expression. What does that mean? Bifnei kol adam. before every human being. How can you feel humble before every human being? There are killer human beings that are, you know, we all know human beings that are not so good. And the answer is very simple. The comrades explain that even, and this is such an important, critical part of being, looking at another human being and not judging another human being. That when I look at another human being, even a human being that is clearly doing things that are completely wrong or immoral or evil, I always need to think to myself, how do I know I would do any better in their circumstance? That's what the commentaries explain to us. How do I know that I'm a better person? Because I don't do that evil thing. Maybe I don't have their tests. Maybe I don't have their challenges. Maybe I wasn't brought up the way they were grown up. Now, it's not excusing anyone to do evil. Evil is a free choice. And that's the way we look, supposed to look at ourselves. In other words, we have a choice, and therefore we're never bound by our circumstances or our upbringing or our DNA or our genes or whatever the case is. That's all true. But the way I look at a human being has to be, that's the ideal, it's a hard thing to do, but has to be that who says that I would do any better given the same set of circumstances? That's the meaning and that's the depth between the saying of the Talmud, be humble, be shval ruach, feel yourself lower than every single human being. So therefore, that's what it means, and when you have that true and as genuine and authentic feeling towards another human being, that cements the relationship. And then you're able to help them. But it doesn't mean that I can't challenge them. In other words, even though I don't believe that I'm better than them, and I believe that given their circumstances, I might do no better or maybe worse, but the fact is that I'm not in that circumstance. And therefore, I am in the position to understand that what they're doing maybe needs help. So I still need to be able to challenge them. So you see, the two things can actually go together. I can accept them fully. I cannot hold myself superior. I can be humble before them. I can think that maybe I would do worse in their circumstance. But God has given me in this particular context the opportunity not to be in that circumstance. And therefore, it's my responsibility to help them. But when you help them in the context of, and the hidden message is, that I'm not helping you because I think you're better than you. I'm not leading you because I think I'm superior to you. Because maybe I would do worse than you in your circumstances, but I happen not to be in your circumstance. Therefore, it's my responsibility to be objective where you can't be objective because you're subjective, and therefore to help you out and to guide you and to lift you and to inspire you. Therefore, those two things really have to go together. And let's see how that works with Abraham Avinu. Going back to Abraham. First of all, going back to an interesting story with Abraham before we get to the real thing. You know, Abraham had a nephew. His name was Lot, who wasn't such a fantastic fellow. He traveled with Abraham. When Abraham left Haran to go to Israel, Lot joined. Lot didn't have a father. There was a whole story. He died young. And so Lot and his family joined Abraham and arrived in Israel. And then the story tells us that a quarrel broke out between the shepherds of Abraham and the shepherds of Lot. So what happened was, the shepherds of Abraham were more moral than the shepherds of Lot. Abraham was a wealthy man, he had lots of flock, but he had instructed his workers to be so moral that when they walk around, they should be muzzled, so therefore that the animals should never ever graze from fields that don't belong to him. Right? In other words, if there was private property, Abraham would be extra careful that his sheep shouldn't graze at all from fields that don't belong to him. Lot, on the other hand, wasn't so careful. He did what other human beings tend to do. He rationalized. He says, listen, truth is it all belongs to me, because he had heard that God had promised Abraham the land of Israel, and Abraham didn't have any kids. So he figured, well, the next one in line is me. So essentially, the whole land belongs to me anyway. So, okay, so right now the title belongs to someone else, but it's not a problem for my sheep to graze and so on and so forth. So they had this whole quarrel, and Abraham wanted to settle this idea. So he called Lot, and the wording is very interesting. And he explains to him that this can't really go on. But if you look clearly at the words, he doesn't judge him in any way. He doesn't blame him in any way. But he does make a stand. And he asks Lot to separate and to choose a place where he could live so that the grazing would be... And ultimately, Lot chose the place of Sodom to live. He lived in Sodom, and that's why he ultimately had to be saved from there. He wasn't as evil as the people of Sodom and so on, right? But you look at the words, it's Abraham ready to challenge, but not to judge, right? But two other interesting things we see with Abraham, where this comes in very, very great emphasis. We said before, Abraham was an hospitable person. He loved hospitality, right? So the story goes, the famous story where he's after his circumcision, he's recovering from surgery, he's 99 years old, and God doesn't want him to be bothered, so he lets him recuperate, and he makes it a very hot day, so there will be no wayfarers, there will be no guests traveling from one point to another. I think we've mentioned this before. And Avraham is very distressed because Avraham loves to be hospitable. He loves to entertain guests. Right? So what does God do? He sees Avraham is in distress, but there's no guests because it's a very hot day and no one's traveling. So he sends these three angels disguised as human beings. Famous three angels who came for other purposes as well, but they came as three angels. Now Avraham looks up and he sees these three people. But let's understand who these people were. Just let's get the context of Avraham, right? Avraham was the person in his life who dedicated his life to two things. Hachnasat Orchim, kindness, but spreading monotheism. That was Avraham's goal. To influence and to inspire the nation, which wasn't the culture of the time, to believe in one God. The culture of the time was the explosion of pagan worship in a very, very, very big way. Pagan worship on all sorts of levels. And that's what Avraham Avinu had to fight, so to speak. He had to be the Ivri, he had to go against the current, as we spoke about last week. So Avraham looks up at these people and he sees what the Medrash terms as Arvim, which is almost translated Arabs, but it's actually not Arabs. It means just the natives of the land of Canaan at the time. And he sees that they're walking and they've got dust on their feet. Now the dust of the feet were significant because in those times, one of the forms of pagan worship was people, I don't know, pagan worship was all kinds of variations. So one of the forms of pagan worship was people to bow down, to serve the dust on their own feet, which was abhorrent to Avraham. And he runs and begs them to come in for a meal. So he clearly, in his perception, this is the reality. He clearly thinks that they're pagan worshippers, but he's desperate to have them as guests, right? He's desperate to have them as guests. Why? Because Avraham had the first attribute of tremendous love, tremendous acceptance. He believed in monotheism. He believed in the one God. To him, pagan worship was ridiculous. There's that famous story when Avraham was a little child with his father Terach, who was a pagan worshipper. Right? His father Terach owned a, I don't know if you're familiar with the Medrash, but it's a famous Medrash. He owned an idol store, right? 7-Eleven to sell idols, right? And one time Avraham Avinu, Terach had to go away, so he left his son in charge of the idol store. So Avraham thought it was a great opportunity. This is the story the Medrash tells. That was the whole background to the miracle of him being saved from the furnace. So Avraham thought, that's great. He's going to do outreach work. Every person that comes to buy an idol, he's going to talk him out of it. And which he did. And it says, you know, a woman came to buy an idol. He says, come on, it's ridiculous. Anyway, at the end, what did Avraham do? The Medrash says, he was a little child. He went and smashed all the idols in the store, except for the biggest one. And he put a stick in the hand of the biggest idol. Terach comes back and he says, what's this? Avraham says, I don't know. I think they had a fight, the idols, and the big one killed them all. Terach says, what are you, ridiculous? So he says, what do you mean ridiculous? And you serve these things? Anyway, so Avraham Avinu from a young age had recognized God as being the creator of the world. To him, idol worship was terrible. Pagan worship in any form was a terrible thing. These people were three people who were pagan worshippers, and yet Avraham runs after them, accepts them, loves them, and begs them. He says, please, just stop in for a drink of water, if nothing else. Right? I don't mind. If you want to rush, I understand you're in a rush. But just come in. I'll welcome you. I'll take into my home, I'll feed you. He runs, he shechts three calves because he wants to give each one a tongue in mustard, Rashi says. All kinds of things. He runs, he was an old man, running around, trying to get meat, trying to get bread, running to Sarah to bake bread, to break matzah, the whole business. Right? Complete love, complete acceptance, even though the pagan worshippers. But yet at the same time, he challenges them. When he invites them in and he begs them to come in, not to leave without coming in for a drink. He says, but please, before you come in, wash your feet. He wouldn't let them into the house before they washed their feet. He wanted them. He was desperate to have them. And yet he had a value. He had a standard. And that standard was one that he was going to spread. He was going to stand up. Even if it took a little bit of strength, a little bit opposite to the whole process of what he was doing. He challenged them. He said, but you've got to wash off your feet. Which probably, I imagine, would have sparked discussion. And Avraham Avinu was going to do that. He was going to challenge them. As much as he loved his guests, he challenged them, because the Medrash also tells us that generally speaking, Avraham Avinu had a practice. Again, he made it his mission to spread belief in God. That when people would come to him, and he would, just the story of the angels gives a bit of insight of how desperate he was to just welcome and accept and just genuinely bring every single person into his house. And he would feed them and feed them lavishly and feed them for free. And yet afterwards, says the Medrash, with all his guests, he would challenge them to bench. Why? Because he wanted to make people aware. He would say to them, you think the food I gave you is mine? The food I gave you comes from a God. He would go into discussion about God. So he would challenge them. He wasn't going to just leave them. He wasn't going to be passive. He had a calling and he had a responsibility. And he accepted that calling. He accepted that mission of making people aware of the terrible mistake of pagan worship which had come into the culture of society. And Avraham Avinu was the one who had been entrusted with the mission. He had been given the opportunity to believe in the one God and to understand the foolishness of pagan worship. And he took that responsibility. He heeded the calling. He understood the opportunity that he has, but not in a context where he felt superior to everyone else, because he would never been successful if he did that. Leadership doesn't work like that. So he took the responsibility, which required a lot of strength. It required a challenge. It would be much easier for Avraham Avinu to go and live alone and just, you know, let the world do what it does, just like Noach did. What do I have to fight with the whole society for? What do I have to make myself unpopular? Why do I have to get into vikuchim, you know, discussions, arguments, debates, and so on and so forth? It's much easier just to, I'll have my belief system, I'll feed people, it's all good and loving and kind, but what do I have to challenge them for? Right? He could have just gone with the spirit of love and kindness that he had, his hospitality, and just left it there. But he couldn't, because he had a collective responsibility and a moral responsibility to challenge people to a better and greater and deeper belief system. And the combination of those two things, right? The combination of the absolute hospitality and love and acceptance and not judgmentalism the way it went, together with the strength and the conviction to be able to challenge them, that combination was an incredible successful leadership model. Because we know that when, even before Abraham came to Israel, when the very, very first test of Abraham recorded in the Torah is recorded, where God comes to him and says, Lech Lecha, go and journey to the land of Israel, and just go to where I'm going to tell you to go. And Abraham didn't even know where he was going, but he had to uproot his whole family and go away from his father's house and the whole business. It says there that Abraham and Sarah left the land of Haran, went to Israel, and they took with them a large following. The exact expression in the verse is, V'etan nefesh asher asu b'charan. They took with them the souls that they had made in Haran. What does that mean? The people who they had inspired, who had become part of the community, who actually changed and changed the belief system, who are now under the influence and guidance of Avraham. Avraham was an incredible successful leader. His mission and his calling to actually bring monotheism to the world was incredibly strong and incredibly successful. Why? Because of two reasons. Because he had what it takes to be a leader, and what it takes everyone to be a leader on whatever level. He had the combination of those two opposites. He had the combination of really not judging people, really genuinely accepting and loving another human being and seeing the value of another human being, and yet still ready to challenge them. In fact, the more you love the human being, the more dedicated you are to the human being, the more you can and therefore should challenge them. It goes together. And that's true in all leadership. We all, as I said last few weeks, the lesson for us not just to analyze a story in the Chumash. That's not the point. The point is to understand that we are all leaders. We all have friends. We all have children. We all have whatever it is. We all have an opportunity to have an influence on others. And very often, either we judge, and that damages our ability to be truly effective, or we don't judge, but we over-accept. In other words, we erroneously think that not judging means to accept them. You know, people always say, accept me how I am. That's not quite true. In other words, yes, we have to accept people how they are. In other words, we have to accept people unconditionally. That the way they are doesn't make them better or worse, but doesn't mean that we can't challenge. And sometimes with children, sometimes with friends, a true friend will challenge. A true friend, the closer you are to someone, sometimes if we're a true friend of someone else, we will point out to them where they've gone wrong, and we will help them out, and we will challenge them. In an accepting way, in a positive way, in a real way, in a dedicated way. But that's a true leader. True friendship or true leadership, in whatever level, doesn't matter how small or big the following is, requires unconditional love, unconditional acceptance, and yet the ability to challenge. It's a hard combination, but that's what makes effective leadership. You know, this concept we just said about accepting, because you know, in today's society, it's a bit hard. People are very into acceptance today. People are very into acceptance, but don't judge me. Now, the truth is, we shouldn't judge anyone, as we said before. But the truth is, first of all, that's never something we should say about ourselves. That's where society's gone completely wrong. We should never say about ourselves, accept me the way I am. Because the truth is, the biggest challenge we have to give is to ourselves. Right? More than we can challenge other people, we have to challenge ourselves. In fact, we should never accept ourselves the way we are, because we all have room to grow, and we all should grow, and we all should take the next step. And that's the first thing we should never do, accept ourselves the way we are. But when it comes to other people, yes, we have to be absolutely not judgmental, absolutely loyal to them and dedicated to them, and accept them unconditionally, which actually means that therefore we can challenge them. The two things have to go together. Moshe Rabbeinu, the next great leader in the Torah story, is an interesting story of how he became a leader. You know, where God made Moses the leader, it was at the burning bush. And it's an interesting story of how that happened. The moment of Moses' appointment as a leader happened when he was at the burning bush, and God appointed him and sent him back to Egypt to lead the Jewish people. How did that happen? So it says that one day he was shepherding his father-in-law's flock. Right? He was shepherding his father-in-law's flock. And the Midrash says, what does it actually mean? What happened was that he was taking care of his father-in-law's sheep. He was a shepherd. And one little lamb ran off. And Moshe Rabbeinu chased that lamb to see where it was going. And he chased it, and he chased it, and he chased it, and he couldn't catch up with it. Until there came to a bit of water, and Moshe Rabbeinu realized that the little lamb, the smallest lamb in the whole flock, was thirsty. And that's when God said that someone who can worry about the smallest lamb in the flock with such responsibility and such dedication, he's going to be the leader of the Jewish people. Right? So Moses, we see that combination as well. We see that on the one hand, he was unbelievably dedicated to every single person that he led. And yet he wasn't afraid to challenge. He challenged God. He challenged the Jewish people. He was okay. He was very, very ready to challenge the Jewish people, and even God for that matter, when it needed to be challenged, right? Which takes us to a little bit of a different idea, but the same sort of thing, that we talk about dedication to others and acceptance. It's not just dedication and acceptance, but actually goes a step further. And it goes into the concept of loyalty. To be a leader, again, on whatever level, it's just not enough to accept a person. We actually have to be dedicated and absolutely loyal to that person. And that's what we see. We see it with Abraham, first of all, again. Going back to the story of Lot. And Lot wasn't such a good guy. And Abraham had to be strong with him a little bit and make him separate and choose another place to live in terms of his flock and so on. But then when Lot was captured, there was a war that broke out. And Lot was captured, and Abraham heard that Lot had been captured. Abraham, this loving, kind Abraham, gathered a little bit of an army and went to war to save his nephew. Because he took responsibility. He could have said, look, now Lot lives in Sodom, I don't have responsibility for him, I wipe my hands off. You never wipe your hands off anyone. If it's someone connected to you, if it's someone that's part of your circle of influence at any level, Avram was ready to go to war for him, and he went to war for him, and he succeeded, and he rescued Lot. There's an amazing insight I saw, something we just read a few weeks ago in the Parsha. You know, I think we mentioned this maybe last week. There was a story of Bilam. Bilam was a prophet, a non-Jewish prophet, who Balak called upon to curse the Jewish people. Now, if we have a look at the story of Bilam, it's interesting that Bilam was a person of tremendous skill. He was a non-Jewish prophet, but the Talmud says, a very interesting thing, the Talmud says that when it says in the Chumash that Moses was the greatest prophet, it says Moses was the greatest prophet amongst Israel, by the Jewish people. In other words, that Bilam's skill and Bilam's level of prophecy was so great it almost equaled Moshe Rabbeinu's. That's how great Bilam was, Right? Balak said to him, I know that whoever you will curse will be cursed, whoever you'll bless will be blessed. Bilam was a great person who understood a lot about godliness and God and so on and so forth. Yet the end with Bilam is that he turned out an evil human being. Why? He came to Israel, he tried to curse them, it didn't work, God wouldn't let him, he blessed them. And at the end, he anyways damaged the Jewish people, because it was him that gave the advice to Balak that if you want to hurt the Jewish people, you should send the daughters of Midian and Moab out to the Jewish people, who will seduce the men, and they'll have all these immoral affairs, and they'll serve idols, and the whole business, and the plague broke out. And it was all Bilam's plan, that, right? So Bilam turned out to be actually an evil person, and he was, at the end, he was punished, and he met not such a good end. So the Talmud says, what went wrong with Bilam? What was Bilam's problem? And Talmud says the most amazing thing. Have a look at his name, you'll see his problem. Bilam was a great person with tremendous skill and knowledge. But his name was Bilam. You know what Bilam means? Bili'am, without a nation. He was a person, a leader, without followers. He wasn't dedicated or loyal to anyone. He didn't care about anyone. He was like a prophet for hire. Like wherever it suited him, that's where he was. Like a sort of real politician type guy. You know? No, I'm sorry. Sorry? Okay, so that's an interesting question. That's an interesting question. The Talmud says that God made him into a prophet so that people wouldn't, because there was an issue that the nations of the world would claim that if we had a prophet, it would also be okay. Like, you know, you gave the Jews Moshe Rabbeinu. It's unfair. Like, why don't you give us a prophet? So God gave him. But everyone has free choice at the end of the day, and Bilam erred. Right? He didn't lead. He didn't take people and become absolutely loyal to them, and he wasn't dedicated to lead. Because leadership, part of the relationship that leaders have with the people they lead, is a part of leadership is a loyalty to the person. Right? And going back to what we said before, the more loyal we are to someone, it doesn't become a contradiction to the concept of challenging, on the contrary. The more loyal we are to a person, the more we really love another person, the more dedicated we are to another person, the more we're ready to challenge them. Because if we really care about another human being, see, why don't we want to challenge sometimes? Why do sometimes people prevent themselves from challenging another human being under the guise of acceptance? I can't challenge them, I've got to accept them the way they are. Why do people do that? Mostly it's because it's too difficult. You don't want to have confrontation, you don't want to get into a situation where someone doesn't listen to you, you don't know how they're going to take it, and so on and so forth. Right? So the lack of ability to challenge actually comes from my own interest. It doesn't come from my dedication to the other person. Because if I accept someone else unconditionally, and I really build a relationship with the other person, and I'm loyal to them and dedicated to them like a leader should be, if I really accept them and I really love them, as Abraham loved every human being, and I really care for them, I would share with them something that I'm passionate about. I would give them and share with them a value that I know I'm so certain about. And then I know that just they don't see it, or maybe they don't understand it, and I could share it with them and I can help them. I can help them become more moral, more holy, more spiritual, whatever the case is. I can help them improve as a human being. If I really care, I'll do it. If I really care, I will challenge. I won't worry about myself. Because the lack of challenging normally doesn't come from love. It comes from being afraid. It comes from a weakness, not a strength. The real strength is to really be dedicated to. But the opposite is also true, by the way. If I challenge someone without accepting them, without loving them, that's also coming from me. It's just about my selfishness. So I need to impose everything that I have on someone else. The combination is the strength. The combination is that I really accept a person. I don't judge them. I don't feel superior to them. I feel humble before every human being, as we said before. And yet, because I have the position to inspire someone else, it's something that they may be unable to inspire themselves with, I take the plunge and I challenge them nonetheless, and that's a real strength, the combination of that. Now, just to end off with another concept, challenging someone in that context brings a whole different result. What do I mean? You see, part of leadership is, we said leadership is inspiring others, guiding others, lifting others, and so on. But what does it mean to inspire someone else? What it doesn't mean is to impose on someone else. Right? Challenging and imposing are two different things. Because imposing me on you is not leadership. Real leadership is where I inspire so that someone else wants to improve. Someone else wants to be inspired. There's a beautiful imagery in the Torah where Aharon HaKohen, Moses' brother, is given the mitzvah of lighting the candelabra every day. And the Pasuk says that he has to light the candelabra. When he used to light the candelabra every day, the menorah, he would hold the match there and light the candle. It says until the candle started to burn on its own. That the candle had to burn on its own. What does that mean? So we are taught that the candle represents the soul of the human being. And Aaron, as in a position of leadership, his mission was to infuse souls with inspiration. But he was told, the way you infuse souls with inspiration is they have to burn on their own. You can't impose your inspiration on them. That's part of being loyal to someone else. Part of accepting it is that you inspire them because you love them, and therefore they want to be inspired. And they want to burn on their own. And they want to change on their own. And they want to be guided on their own. Not imposing something is not real leadership. Imposing something is ineffective. Real leadership is inspiring and influence, as we said, not power but influence, to the point where the person wants to come along. Now, of course, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you have to put your foot down. And there are positions of authority. We spoke about this last week, that sometimes leadership calls for power and authority in certain circumstances. But ultimate leadership is not about that. Ultimate leadership is inspiring, that the flame burns on its own. I might have told you this story once before, but Yehuda Avner, who wrote the book The Prime Minister, is a great book. In his book, tells a story of a meeting that he had, a long meeting that he had with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And Yehuda Avner was quite a strong person, and he wasn't scared to challenge. And he challenged the Rebbe in this audience. And they spoke a lot of political stuff, but part of the discussion centered around what is the relationship between a chassid and a Rebbe. So he said to the Rebbe, "So what's a Rebbe? Tell me, what's a Rebbe?" So the Rebbe gave him this analogy of lighting candles, that a soul is like a candle, and the mission, the role of a Hasidic Rebbe or a Rebbe or a leader in general is to light the candles that should burn. Sometimes it doesn't burn properly, to inspire people, in other words. Because at the beginning, it came at the back of the conversation, at the beginning of the whole discussion, he made it very clear to the Rebbe that he had come to see the Rebbe, but in no way he was a follower of the Rebbe, he wasn't a Hasid. He made that very clear. So, and then he challenged him to ask him what the position of a Rebbe is. Anyway, they spoke for very, very long, all different types of things. At the very, very end of the audience, he turned to the Rebbe and he said, "Nu Rebbe, do you think you've been successful? Have you lit my candle?" To which the Rebbe responded and he said, "No, but I've given you a match." Because the candle you have to light on your own at the end of the day. Right? But my role is not to light your candle, actually. My role is to give you the match that you can burn on your own. And that comes with a lot of things. It comes with a real connection. It comes with that combination of challenging, but having a real relationship. It comes with listening. You know, Viktor Frankl tells a story, interesting story. Viktor Frankl tells a story that once a patient called him in the middle of the night to tell him calmly that she was about to commit suicide. So he kept her on the phone for 2 hours with all kinds of reasons and explanations why it wasn't a good idea for her to commit suicide. And at the end she agreed and she didn't commit suicide. The next day or the next week or whatever, sometime after, he met the woman. And he said to her, "I'm just interested, which one of the reasons that I gave you, which one of the explanations actually convinced you out of committing suicide?" So she said, "None of them." So he says, "So why didn't you?" She said, "Because the fact that someone was prepared to listen to me for 2 hours in the middle of the night convinced me that life was worth living." Right? So it's that, I'll just say that because it's that combination that comes together. Challenging someone is vital when it comes to leadership, but it's only really effective when there's a true relationship. So both things really have to work together. One without the other simply is ineffective leadership. And that's true with all of us, and it's true with all the people that we come into contact with. Having a real relationship with someone, accepting them truly, authentically, that they never ever feel judged, meaning in the sense they never ever feel that you're superior to them, or they never ever feel that you think that in your circumstance, if you were given their opportunity, they would do better than you. On the contrary, as we said before, being humble means that, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu was humble. It says in the Chumash, a famous concept, that Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble of all human beings. And the commentaries ask the question, what do you mean Moshe Rabbeinu was the most humble? He was the greatest prophet. He was the greatest person. He knew he was the greatest leader. Humility doesn't mean to be stupid. Humility doesn't mean false humility. He knew he had achieved things that no other human being had achieved. And there's many, many explanations, but in the context of this discussion, one of the explanations that is given is that Moshe Rabbeinu was shown a vision. Before he died, it says God showed him a vision of future, of future Jewish history. And he saw Jews, that's what it says. He saw people in generations that were tough. He saw people at the end of time before the coming of Mashiach, which would be living in very, very challenging times, both physically or spiritually, whether it's persecution or spiritual persecution, whatever the case be. And he saw the Jewish nation still hanging on to Jewishness, still being eternal, still being determined, still being resilient. Suddenly it says that Moshe Rabbeinu felt humble. That's a leader. Why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu was convinced that if he, with his all achievements, the reason that he achieved them was because he was given an opportunity, but he felt that if he would be in the situation of the people that he saw a vision of, maybe he wouldn't be as successful. Maybe he wouldn't even be as great as them. He felt humble before the people who weren't given the opportunity that he was given. And yet he was able to challenge. So when we're able to, when a person feels, when we have a real relationship with a person and truly see them as a valuable human being, truly don't judge them, and yet at the same time, because of our loyalty and dedication to them, we are ready to challenge them. And so we should, and ready to help each other and ourselves grow, the combination of those two opposites is what really creates effective leadership. So that's the concept that I wanted to share today, those combination of the two opposites. And next week we'll take other aspects of leadership. Have a wonderful week.